story is told of a professor who was somewhat absent-minded. And just before he went off to work on a given morning, his wife came and turned the collar down on his suit coat and wiped off the dandruff and reminded him that today was the day they were moving. And she said, "Now, I have gone to the trouble of taking the key for our present apartment off your key ring and putting on it the key for our new apartment. And just in case you forget where we've moved to, I've put a little map inside your suit coat pocket with the directions and address on it." And off went our professor friend to work. That afternoon, he came back to the original apartment, reached into his pocket for his keychain, took out the key, and tried to insert it in the lock, and of course it wouldn't go in. And he pushed and squirmed and wiggled it, but still couldn't get in, and then all of a sudden he remembered. "Of course," he said, "today was the day we were going to move." But he couldn't remember where they were going to move to. And he forgot all about the little map and address that was inside his coat pocket. Just then he noticed a young fellow standing just down the hallway, and he said, "Hey, fellow, do you know who lives in this apartment?" And he said, "Yes, I do." He says, "Well, now they've moved. Do you happen to know where they've moved to?" The young fellow says, "Well, it's all right, Dad. Mum thought you'd forget anyway." Now, any similarity between that father and a Christian father is purely coincidental. Our subject this morning is a Christian husband. And I would like to ask now for you wives to move about 3 or 4 inches away from your husband so that you will not be able to give them an elbow any time during the message this morning. All right? Well, just those 3 or 4 safe inches, that's right. That'll save a lot of sore ribs by the end of our message. And just in case you wives are inclined to gloat, come back this afternoon, because it's going to be your turn at 3 o'clock this afternoon. A Christian husband. What is he anyway? Seems to me that the Word of God is very, very clear in pointing out that there are 3 things that really constitute the responsibility of a Christian husband to his wife. May I ask you to turn to Ephesians chapter 5, please, where 2 of them will appear, and then a 3rd one will appear in 1 Peter chapter 3. Ephesians chapter 5 is the central passage in the Word of God on the husband-wife relationship. And in verses 25, 26, and 27, we will be reading about the husband in a moment and find out a characteristic of his responsibilities there. But before we move in directly to the husband, who is addressed in verse 25, we want to look at the verses addressed to the wife, because in those verses we will in fact find the first responsibility of the husband. Paul says in verse 22, "Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything." Now, it would appear from these verses that the first responsibility of a Christian husband is to manage his home. Now, I understand that to be the primary significance of the phrase that he is to be the head of his wife, and as a result, the head of his home. As head of his home, his responsibility is to manage that home. Now, there are some things that are obviously implied in the imagery that is used here, that he is to manage his home as Christ manages the church, being the head of the church. The first thing that is implied from the fact that the husband is the head of the wife is a very vital union. Just as there is a vital union between Christ, the head, and the church, the body, so there is a vital union that exists between the husband and the wife. That union is so vital that the husband is referred to as the head in that union. Not only is there an implication concerning a vital union, but it's obvious that there is also an implied great authority that goes with this. The husband is given the responsibility of being the head of the home. His responsibility as the head is to manage the home. Now that immediately tears down one of the basic distinctions that we are inclined to make in our way of life today, where we say that the man has the office that he manages and the wife has the home that she manages. Now that is not biblical. The husband is to be the manager of the home. He is to be the head of that home. It implies great authority. His responsibility is to manage that home, to be the manager of it. Many husbands, most husbands, I suspect, have forfeited that responsibility, and they have given it to their wives. And that is probably one of the results of the tremendous pressure that is put upon a man in the secular business world where he works 5.5 days a week. That kind of pressure has been such that he has forfeited the authority that God has given to him in a home, and he has given that over to his wife. The man has a solemn responsibility then to work as the manager, as the head of that home. There is great authority that is involved in that position. Now, of course, as is true of any manager, it is also true that a husband has the prerogative to delegate his authority. To be the manager does not mean that he does everything. The thing that makes a good manager is that he is competent in delegating authority. And that, of course, is what a husband does in a home. Although he is the manager of the home, he delegates authority in that home, sometimes to his wife, sometimes to an older child. But the authority is delegated to those individuals by father, who ultimately has the authority in that home. So the second thing that is implied in headship, then, is great authority. The third thing that is surely implied in this headship is a solemn responsibility. As the manager is ultimately responsible for anything that takes place in his company or in his office, so the husband is ultimately responsible for all that takes place in his home. We have already been observing something of this in action in the political world today. President Nixon has publicly assumed the responsibility for what has taken place in his administration. Now, to what degree he was involved or was responsible, none of us shall speculate. But he was absolutely right in taking the responsibility for what happened. Because as the manager of an administration, he is responsible for all that takes place in that administration. Now, my dear sir, that is exactly true in your life. You are responsible to God for all that takes place in that home of yours. You shall someday stand before God and give an account to him of how your children have turned out. You shall give an account to him of the discipline or the lack of discipline that you have exercised in your home. You are responsible for all that takes place in that home. So there is tremendous responsibility involved in being the manager of a home. Now, I think it is very striking to note that in the passage that is before us here, that is the first responsibility laid down to the husband. We would be inclined, I think, to put the second or third first. But it is very significant that God puts as the first responsibility the headship of the man in the home. I mentioned the other night that when a justice of the Supreme Court went to Italy to investigate why it was that juvenile delinquency was lower in Italy than any other major country in the world, he wrote back and said, the answer is, in 9 words, put the father back as head of the home. And that is the order that God has ordained, that father be manager, that father be the head of the home. I have a physician friend who was in general practice. As his children grew into teenage years, he began to realize that he was losing that contact with his children, that opportunity to know what was going on and to guide his children. And so he left general practice, went back to school to specialize and become a radiologist so that he could have virtually a 9-to-5 job where he could be a manager, the head of his home. Now, I respect a businessman that way very, very much. I may say, my dear sir, if I may with kindness, that I am not at all convinced that all of the promotions that have come to you in your business endeavors are of God. I am very, very aware of the fact that one of the ways that the devil has crippled many godly men is to promote those men in their businesses so that they have become so tied up with their role as a manager or as a president or an executive that they have forfeited their role as manager of their home. And so I do not go around patting men on the back and congratulating them on how their businesses have expanded or the great promotions that they have got in their business until I see how they handle that promotion. And as I see their spiritual life begin to wane and their leadership in the chapel begin to be set aside, I begin to have my questions. But the final answer is what happens in their home. And as they begin to forfeit that position of leadership and headship so that they do not know what is happening in their homes and they are not managing their wives and managing their children, then I see that the devil has won a victory in that man's life. And the way he did it was as subtle as the way he tempted Eve. He tempted her with a higher position. Wouldn't you like to be like God, knowing good and evil? Why, of course I'd like that higher position. And Eve was beguiled. And that is exactly how the devil has crippled many men, by offering to them higher positions, and they have forfeited their roles in the home. The first responsibility that you have as a husband is to be the manager of your home. Are you that this morning? Do you know your children? Do you know your wife? Are you managing your home? One of the best ways to do that is to establish a family council. I think a family council is a very, very practical way to establish the headship of a father. That is the time when the family gathers together generally once a week and they have a council. The father leads the council. It is at the family council that allowances are given out, that complaints from the parents are registered to the children, that the children have a form where they can register their complaints against their parents or against their children. When disciplines are administered, when it is determined what the policy will be in disciplining this situation, a family council can be a tremendous time for bringing cohesion to a family, but particularly for establishing father as the manager of that home. And it has been generally one of the happiest things that we have done in our home. During the winter, when we are around the home, I have one night a week that I make as family night. And we light the fireplace in our living room. We sit around the fireplace. We pop popcorn or roast wieners. And we have our family council. And that is the time that the responsibilities of the back week are reviewed, responsibilities for the coming week are administered or distributed, allowances are given out, complaints are handled, and so on. And it has been a tremendous thing to force me into the role of being the manager of my home, because I am absolutely no different than you men. I have all kinds of pressures and responsibilities that can tear me apart from my home and build family as well. Number one responsibility is that we be the manager of our home as head in that home. The second responsibility is developed in verses 25 through the end of the chapter. And in this chapter, in this passage, we discover that our second responsibility is to love our wives. It says in verse 25, husbands, love your wives. Now, before we proceed, let me inform you, if you do not already know, I'm sure that many of you do because of the Bible teachers you have in the chapel here, that the English word love is the translation of four Greek words. There is one Greek word, eros, which means a sexual passionate love. That does not happen ever to occur in the New Testament. The second Greek word, storge, is for the kind of love that you have to your children as a parent. The third Greek word, phileo, is the word for a warm friendship that you would have to other believers. The fourth Greek word is agapao, and that is the verb that is used here, to love your wife. It is not an emotional love. It is rather a volitional love. It is not something that is selfish. It is something that is selfless. It is something that a husband decides to do. It is not something that he feels like doing. It is something in which the husband acts in such a way that he seeks what is the good of the person that he is loving, that is his wife. Now that is the verb that is used here, so do not misunderstand Paul or the scriptures. He is not talking about an emotional feeling towards your wife. He is talking about a decision that you will make, a decision to seek that which is the good or the best for your wife. Now, it's very significant in these passages that two similes are used. That is, you are to love your wife as two things. First of all, verses 25 through 27. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. You and I as husbands are to love our wives as Christ loved the church. There is the standard. There is the pattern. Sometimes we sing when we talk about this. From heaven he came and sought her to be his holy bride. With his own blood he bought her, and for her life he died. Now that is my standard as a husband. I am to love my wife as Christ loved the church and gave his life for that church. I am not then to be willing to give my life for my wife. That is not what it says. As I illustrated on Friday night, that would not be difficult if some communist soldiers came to the front door insisting to have my wife. It would be a very easy thing for any of us as husbands to give our lives and to say, you will have to kill me before you touch her. But that is not what is involved here. What is involved is that I am to not just be willing to die for her, I am to give my life for her. I am to lay my life down at her feet and give my life for her as Christ gave his life for the church. When you stand at the altar to be married then, my young man friend, and you turn to your young lady and say that you love her, if you are going to be a Christian husband, what you are saying is, from this day forward, I lay down my life at your feet. I give my life for you. When you get in that warm embrace with your fiancé and are tempted then to tell her that you love her, remember that if you are to be a Christian man, that means that you are not getting, but you are giving. And you are giving your life for her. As you and I have been married, I've been married almost 18 years. Some of you have been married many more years than that. As we are married and look at wives that we have lived with for years and tell them tenderly that we love them, what we are meaning is that we are giving our lives for them. That is what it means to love your wife. Now, why do you give your life for your wife? That is, in what sense are you giving that life to accomplish what? Have you ever wondered why, in our passage here, verses 26 and 27 are included? I've often read this passage and wondered if he's talking about the home and marriage, why he ever includes that Christ may sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. That is the progressive sanctification of the church. Christ gave his life that he might progressively sanctify the church. Verse 27 says, so that he might ultimately sanctify it. That is, ultimately present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it would be holy and without blemish. Now watch very, very carefully. Christ gave his life for the church, that he might progressively sanctify it and ultimately sanctify it so that it would be perfect in that coming day. Now that is why he gave his life for the church. As a Christian husband, I am to love my wife and give my life. Why? To do the same thing with her. That is, my life is to be given to cultivate and develop and bring her, in a sense, through a progressive sanctification and to an ultimate state of spiritual and emotional and character maturity. Now, that is the way I understand this passage. I understand, then, that my responsibility as a husband is to give my life to bring my wife to maturity, to bring my wife to perfection. She has, for example, a spiritual gift. Just as your wife has a spiritual gift, if she is a Christian. Every Christian has a spiritual gift. My responsibility as a husband is to love my wife and to give my life for her and bring that spiritual gift into maturity, to encourage the development of that gift, to cultivate that gift, to provide a context whereby that gift can be developed and exercised, to encourage her into a ministry in our neighborhood or in the church so her gift can mature and so that ultimately she can reach that maturity. You look at your wife and you see that she has some particular talent. Your responsibility is to love your wife and to give your life to bring those talents into their full bloom, into their full maturity. Your wife has certain potentials in her character. Your responsibility as a husband is to love her and give your life for her to cultivate and blossom and move in the molding and forming of that character into its full maturity. Now, I frankly find this to be absolutely stimulating and startling. My responsibility, then, is to bring my wife to maturity, spiritually, emotionally, in the exercise of her gift, in the development of her talents. That's why Christ gave his life, for that church. And it seems to me, then, that if that is certainly true, that I am going to be giving my time and giving my ability to mature her and to cultivate her and to develop her. Now, I want you to go on and notice in the last part of the chapter that the second simile is given. Verse 28, so ought men to love their wives, here it is, as their own bodies. So I am to love my wife not only as Christ loved the church, but I am to love my wife also as I love my own body. There is the second simile that is before me. I am to love her as I love my own body. The point is obvious. It is because she is part of my body. Notice it states that very explicitly in verse 28. So ought men to love their wives as their own body. Now that union between the husband and wife is illustrated in verses 29 and 30. It says, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. So in verses 29 and 30, the union that exists between the husband and wife is illustrated by the union that exists between Christ and the church. And then in verse 31, that union is symbolized. He says, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. That phrase, one flesh, is used five times in the Bible, and the basic connotation is the physical union between a husband and wife within marriage. And that symbolizes the oneness that exists between the husband and wife. That wife is part of the husband. She is part of his body. Marriage, then, is not simply two people living together under the same roof and sharing the same name. Marriage simply is not just two people agreeing to live in a marriage state together. Marriage is two personalities coming together so that they become the male and the female of that one entity. That is what marriage is. And the wife is part of the husband. She is one with the husband just as much as a bow and violin are one instrument. Just as much as the three persons of the Trinity are one God. And just as much as Christ and the church are one, so the husband and wife are one. Now, your wife is part of your body. She is part of you. That is stated, illustrated, and symbolized. And every time you express yourself in your physical union with your wife, you are symbolizing the fact that she is part of you. She is a member of your body. Now, says the scripture, I as a husband am to love my wife as part of me. Now, how do I love me? Well, he gives us two words that really demonstrate how we love ourselves. And those two words are in the middle of verse 29. He says, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but here they are. He nourishes it, and he cherishes it. And that is what I am to do with the wife that is part of my body. I am to love her as my own body, nourishing her, first of all. Now, that word nourishing means really to feed her. That is really what is involved. As a matter of fact, when the Old Testament was translated into the language of the New Testament, this very verb was used when Joseph provided the feed for his brothers on their return trip. That is what it means. He gave that feed to nourish them. And so I discover then that as I am so careful about feeding my body, which is obvious to you when you see me in a bathing suit. As I am very careful about taking care and feeding my body and nourishing that body, I am also to love my wife, to give my life, to nourish her, to feed her. And that is just the material side of life. But in the same connotation, there is the spiritual connotation. That is, as I am responsible for nourishing my own spiritual life, I am also responsible for nourishing the spiritual life of my wife. She is part of me. Now, you will discover, men, that that will revolutionize your marriage. It is your responsibility to spiritually nourish your wife. And if I may suggest it, one of the most delightful things that you will ever experience in marriage is sitting down and having a quiet time, a prayer time, a Bible reading time with your wife. Now, that is not your wife's responsibility. She is not responsible to initiate it. She is not responsible to perpetuate it. She is not responsible to lead it. That is your responsibility. We are to nourish our wives as we nourish our bodies. She's part of my body. And my responsibility is the spiritual nourishment of my wife. You are making one of the greatest mistakes of your life as a man if you leave the spiritual nourishment of your wife to the man who preaches behind this pulpit, or to the young lady who, or the older lady who teaches the women's Bible class. It is your responsibility, sir, to nourish spiritually your wife. And one of the great thrills in your life will be to see your wife mature. You know what one of the most pathetic things in our churches today is? The women are more spiritual than the men. That is one of the most pathetic things that I see as I go around. And I wonder how that has ever happened. It is so absolutely contrary. Now, the reason is because of the home. The reason why the women are spiritual in the church and the men are not is because in the home, the men have not taken that place of being the spiritual leaders, nourishing their wives and bringing them to spiritual maturity. So that is the first dimension in which we love our wives as part of our own body. Now, the second one just becomes a little tender when you're away from home for a whole weekend and have to talk about your wife, because it says that we also cherish it. How do you take care of your body? Well, you cherish that body. What is the first thing you do when you hit your thumb with a hammer? I mean, after you count it to 10. What's the first thing you do? Well, you put it in your mouth and you start to suck on it. And then you get a hold of it and you wiggle it and rub it, and then you hold it to yourself. And you cherish that little member of your body that's been hurt. It's interesting that the verb that is translated cherish here in classical Greek means to warm or to heat or to cuddle. It means to hold close to one's bosom. And that is what you do with your body when it is injured, when it is hurt. This same verb was used in the Old Testament by Isaiah to describe the way a mother bird sits on her nest and warms and heats the eggs. This is exactly the verb that Paul used when he described his concern as a gentle nurse for those Thessalonians in 1 Thessalonians 2. He cherished them. He warmed them. He cuddled them. Now that is what we are to do with our wives. If the word nourishing deals with the material and spiritual feeding of our wives, then the cherishing. I have a friend who in their budget have what they call a sanity fund. You know what a sanity fund is? Well, whenever he comes home from work, if he finds that his wife is haggard and worn out, and that she's had a hard day with the children, they had budgeted some money so that he can immediately phone up a babysitter and take his wife out from the home, away from the children, for supper that night. That's their sanity fund. Now, the response of many of us is, well, Bill, we can't afford to do that. My response to that, my friend, is you cannot afford not to do that. Anything you do for your wife, you see, you are doing for yourself. It is not a selfishness. You are doing for yourself, and you are doing for that marriage and that home situation. And it is a very important thing that as a Christian husband, you are very concerned about the cherishing of that wife of yours, about meeting those emotional needs and meeting the physical needs that she has. Someone has attempted to outline the 7 stages of a cold. Here they are. In the first year, the husband looks at his new bride who's just got a cold and says, "Sugar dumpling, I'm worried about my baby girl. You must have a few days in the hospital to get rid of that cold. I don't expect you to eat that terrible hospital food, so I'm going to have your food sent up from Howard Johnson. The second year, she gets another cold. Listen, darling, I don't like the sound of that cough. You be a good girl and go to bed for Papa. I'll see that everything is looked after. Third year. Come, sweetheart. Maybe you'd better lie down. I'll bring you something to eat. Fourth year. Look, dear, after you feed the kids and get the dishes washed, you better hit the sack. Fifth year. Get yourself a couple of aspirin. Sixth year. If you just gargle or something, then stop sitting around barking. And the seventh year, for Pete's sake, stop sneezing. You want to give me pneumonia? Now, that is not the attitude of a Christian husband. He is to cherish his wife just as he cherishes his own body, because she is part of him. So that is the second aspect, then, of a husband's responsibility. He is to love his wife. And he loves her as Christ loved the church. He gives his life to bring her to maturity and develop her. He loves her as he loves his own body, nourishing and cherishing her and meeting those emotional and physical and material and spiritual needs that she has in her life. That is the second great aspect, then, of the husband's responsibility. He is not only to manage his home, but he is to love his wife. And the third and last one is found in 1 Peter chapter 3. So let's turn over to that verse, please. 1 Peter chapter 3. For the third responsibility of the Christian husband. And here is that very striking verse, verse 7, which deals with that major area of responsibility. He says, in like manner, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife, as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. Now, will you note that verse very carefully? It's obvious from it that the third responsibility we have as husbands is to honor our wives. Do you see that verse? We are to honor our wives. Now, if you were with us in the Sunday school hour, you will immediately catch the significance of this. We spoke to you children about honoring your mother and father and pointed out that that verb means to value them, to esteem them as very priceless, to regard them as very highly esteemed, to respect them highly. That is what that verb really means. And it is then implied that the husband is to not only manage his wife and not only love his wife, but he is to honor his wife. He is to treat his wife as a very valuable, priceless, respected, esteemed object. He is to honor his wife. Now notice carefully, there are two similes that are given to us in this verse. First of all, he is to honor his wife as the weaker vessel. It's rather interesting, isn't it? I once conducted I attended a marriage ceremony, marriage wedding. My wife was the maid of honor, and just as the officiating minister began the ceremony, the groom fell flat on the floor. And he went out like a light. They fanned him and worked over him, and finally somebody brought a chair, and they sat a chair under him, and he lifted him up and dropped him on the chair. And with his head between his knees, drooping over on the floor, he went through the entire marriage ceremony. And this little stripling of a bride was standing there just as strong and as proud as punch. The whole audience fell apart in laughter when the officiating minister read this verse in the middle of the ceremony, that he was to honor her as the weaker vessel. And here he was flattened out. We sometimes wondered about this, haven't we? An anonymous poet says, the weaker sex is understood to mean the whole of womanhood, but I have yet to find a man who knows whom it is weaker than. And there is some truth to that. In what sense is the woman the weaker vessel? Well, it is in the sense that she is a very delicate, a very finely tuned instrument. And the husband is to honor her, to respect her, to esteem her highly, very much the way you wives would treat a very fine piece of china in contrast with a plastic cup and saucer. The plastic cup and saucer you would drop in the dishwasher or you would throw into the sink. But that very fine china cup and saucer, you wouldn't put that in the dishwasher. You will do that by hand. You handle that very carefully. Now that is the connotation of our phrase. That the husband is to honor his wife as that kind of a vessel. She is a delicately put together instrument. She is something that is very valuable and very priceless, and she is to be esteemed as that by her husband. Sometimes, you know, we recognize that in our courtship days. When Billy Graham preaches on this verse, he illustrates it by saying, you remember when, before you got married, you used to drive up in front of the building and it was raining and there was puddles on the ground and you would come over and you would open up the door for that young lady that you loved so much and put your coat down on the ground and wash away the water and help her gingerly over the water into the building. You're treating her like a very delicate and valuable object. And then 3 or 4 years later, he says, you drive up to the same building and it's raining just the same and there are puddles of water all around and you're anxious to get the car parked, so you turn to her and you say, jump, lady, I think you can make it. Now we are to treat our wives as delicately, finely tuned instruments that God has brought into our lives. The second simile is that we are to honor them as being heirs together of the grace of life. That is, I am to honor my wife as someone who has become a co-heir of the grace of God that has brought her into a spiritual life just like mine. And this is one of the things that we shall be talking about this afternoon. It completely annihilates any concept of inferiority. She is inferior in no sense whatsoever. She is also an heir of the grace of life, if we interpret that to refer to spiritual life and the grace of God that ministers that life. So I look at my wife and I see her as someone who is the object of God's grace. God in his matchless grace has reached down to that sinful woman. And through the grace of God and the blood of Jesus Christ, he has saved her. And he has redeemed her to himself. And she is the possessor of the very life of God. And it is pulsating through her veins. I am to honor her. I am to esteem her, prize her, respect her, and value her as one who is the very object of God's grace. And, said Peter, the man who is too ignorant to know how to treat his wife, the man who is so foolish that he does not see that his wife is the most prized possession that God has given to him, that man's prayers go unheard. The verse concludes, that your prayers be not hindered. That man's prayers are hindered who does not know how to treat his wife and does not value her as the most priceless possession that God has brought into his life. May God help us as husbands to manage our home, to love our wives, and to honor our wives, because that's a Christian husband.